This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, April 1st, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. The plea bargain turns the justice system on its head, and the trend toward plea bargaining has virtually eliminated one of the most important protections of our criminal justice system, the jury trial. Dan Cannon is author of the new book, Pleading Out. We spoke last week.
Cato's Clark Neely and Somil Trivedi of the ACLU and others and I have talked a lot about the jury trial, about plea bargaining, about charge stacking, about the degree to which our criminal justice system has been successful at eliminating the jury trial. Before we get into a lot of the meat of what Pleading Out, the title of your book, about what pleading out looks like, how did the founders of the United States of America understand the jury trial? What was the value of the jury trial in their eyes?
Yeah, I mean, the value was tremendous, right? You know, as sort of a conduit for civic responsibility, right? For lack of a better way of saying it, and you know, you've got this sort of early sense that the jury trial was this thing that the King of England was taking away from people. That keeping people away from, keeping people off of juries and taking jury trials out of areas where they needed to be. And that, is actually part of the original Declaration of Independence. You've got this, indictment of the king for taking jury trials away from people. And, but their understanding of what the jury was and how powerful the jury was supposed to be, particularly in New England, was much different than the way that we understand it now, because juries were more powerful then. Right, and that's the interesting thing that I really didn't have a good grasp on until I started researching for the book, was that juries now tell us, give us fact findings. They're the fact finder, right? So they say, well, the whether or not the car ran the red light, that's sort of the function of the jury now. But up until about 1850 in New England, you've got a situation in which the jury says not only what the facts are, but what the law is. So not only did the car run the red light? It's a bad example for the 19th century, but still, but whether or not it's illegal to run a red light. And having that kind of power concentrated in a citizen jury, once working class people started sitting on the juries, was a big deal. Like, it was a problem once universal white male suffrage kicked in.
And so the role of the jury in determining not just facts, but also the law itself, would seem to be a perhaps disciplining force when it came to writing laws.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I mean, the jury was really sort of the conscience of the community, which was, not a great thing when only select few, like landed white men could serve on juries. But as I said, they started stripping those powers away from the jury right about the same time that universal white male suffrage became a thing nationwide. So by 1830, when you see the emergence of plea bargaining, you've also got universal white male suffrage, and there's this concerted effort in Massachusetts where we see plea bargaining begin. You also see that jury trials become more complicated. They start introducing all these, sort of opaque rules of evidence, these letters and numbers that we know today, and start making it less accessible to lay juries, to working class people. And also there's the courts and the legislatures ultimately start taking away the power of juries to decide what the law is. And that was enormously controversial in the 1850s in Massachusetts. But now it's just like what we accept about juries. They're just the finders of fact.
Okay, so finders of fact, that's a really narrow category, and I've heard that stated before by friends who are prosecutors, that, it is a complicating factor to have juries that wield a great deal of power. You said that the plea bargain originated in Massachusetts. What set that off?
So, as best as we can tell, the plea bargaining, as we know it now, was illegal prior to the 1830s in Massachusetts, really right up to the 1840s in Massachusetts. You can see records of, I talk in the book about, I think the guy's name is Asael Huntington, who was a prosecutor in Massachusetts who actually got prosecuted for offering deals to defendants. So right up until the 1840s, even in Massachusetts, this is this, you know, controversial sort of thing. Well, all of a sudden, you see the number of guilty pleas go way up in Boston. And I think by the time you get to the 1850s, you're talking about a 50% guilty plea rate on criminal cases. And the 1880s, I think you're up to almost 90% guilty plea rate, to the cases resolved by guilty plea. So it's just this enormous growth in Massachusetts in a short period of time. And it's because the courts were actively involved in trying to break the back of organized labor at the same time. So in the 1840s, you've got this decision, you know, it becomes this critical mass. There's these workers that go in. The 1830s, you've got, you know, the population of Boston itself just shoots up by 50% because you've got all these immigrant laborers coming in from all over the country and from Europe. And so there's this mass of working classes. 1834, you've got the first Federation of Labor Unions that forms in New York, and the ruling classes are getting scared. They're like, okay, we got to do something about this. So the first thing they try to do is just, let's prosecute them all for organizing under the conspiracy statutes. Well, that doesn't work for very long because, you know, people are getting beat up. The prosecution witnesses are getting beat up outside the courthouse and that kind of thing.
And who's being called to serve on juries?
Yeah, right. And it's the same time. It's about the same time that this, you've got this massive expansion of who can be on a jury, you know? And at the same time, they figure, well, we got to start, you know, taking powers away from the jury. But we also need a way to prosecute working class people. We can't do it in a big group because they'll catch on to that. So let's start prosecuting them for like little things like vagrancy, drunken disorderly, you know, whatever, these sort of broad criminal statutes. Unless we'll go out and get a whole bunch of them at a time. And we'll make sure that a jury never sees this, right? That never sees these prosecutions. So you've got this enormous rise in plea bargained cases and pleaded cases at the same time that the courts say, okay, we can't prosecute. In 1842, they say, we can't prosecute workers just for organizing under conspiracy statutes. That's not going to work anymore. So you got to figure out something else. And at the same time that you have working class people sitting on juries.
A couple of things you mentioned there. One is that, was this an active attempt to prevent cases from seeing a jury, that is to say, being exposed to jurors?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And you could chalk it up to coincidence, right? You know, that the legal system is actively trying to quash the nascent labor movement, and you've got working class people sitting on juries for the first time, you know, and the rise of plea bargaining. Okay, that all happens at the same time. Maybe that's a coincidence. I don't think so. I think they're trying to take the criminal cases away from juries, and they were very successful at it.
One other thing that you mentioned is the idea of trying to prosecute people for smaller crimes. And that seems to me to be part and parcel. If you eliminate jury trials, if your conviction rates by guilty pleas goes way up, that would seem to reduce the pressure on lawmakers not to have so many laws on the books.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. And that sort of leads us to where we are now. I mean, you see this giant explosion in the criminal law because it's popular. You know, I mean, if you're a politician, it's almost never bad. And it's never been bad in the history of America that I know of to say, well, let's get a little bit tougher on at least a certain kind of crime, right? You know, maybe in the last 20 years, we've gotten around to thinking, okay, well, tough on crime policies are not going to work. But for most of American history, it's like, well, we're going to take care of these criminals and we're going to clear up our streets and we're going to, you know. And so criminal laws, you know, even now are very, very popular and they're easy to get through state legislatures. And we just set about, particularly, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, just set about to criminalizing everything that we can possibly think of.
So in the modern context, we see the average American, they may be have that urge to punish that a lot of us feel. It's a shameful urge, I think, in general. But we all have that urge in some cases to throw the book at them. And so we elect people who are, you know, aligned in that way. But the flip side of that is very few people are ultimately exposed to the humans who are being accused of the things that we have generally been supportive of, or should say, laws passed by politicians that we've been genuinely supportive of. So in some sense, it feels like the balance has been thrown off.
Yeah. And here's the interesting thing too. It's like, so even for those of us that are really involved in the day-to-day sort of, you know, turnings of the wheel of criminal justice, and you understand how terrible the thing is, and you've been in the jails, and, you know, you've looked at the thing in its ugly eye, you know, there's still this sort of ancient aversion to criminals, right? You know, and it's like, that's why this is so effective. That's why the creation of this huge criminal class in the United States has been so effective. Like, slapping the criminal label on somebody is, there's something in the reptile part of our brains that is like, you know, well, we don't want to hang out with that person. We don't want to interact with a criminal. We can't team up with a criminal. We don't want our kids to date criminals, for heaven's sake, right? Even the most progressive of us on criminal justice issues. And, you know, the interesting thing, you get into the psychology of the thing, and I think it's there in one of the chapters of the book, where not only does putting a criminal label on somebody alienate them from the rest of society, but it actually alienates them from themselves, right? And it makes them more likely to engage in antisocial behaviors and more likely to, you know, reoffend and to withdraw from society in general. So it is a very effective solidarity killer. Like, putting a criminal label on, you know, almost a third of the adult population, which is where we are now, just breaks up working class solidarity in a very effective way. Much more effective, by the way, than prosecuting large groups of workers.
So the plea bargain, I spoke with, as I mentioned, Sumil Trivedi of the ACLU about this, and he was detailing why it is viewed as coercive for plea bargains to exist. And there are, of course, a lot that goes into making plea bargains an attractive option for people. That is, you go to trial, you'd be facing this, you take a plea bargain, you get this. This is a lot better, a much shorter sentence. Sure, you plead guilty to this or that, but you're out in X or no jail time or whatever. And denying the jury trial has a lot of impacts that we don't really fully understand. So help me understand very clearly, in your view, why is the plea bargain a coercive tool? And let's be clear, a tool coercing you against the exercise of a constitutional right.
Yeah, because we've done in this country what no other country, even countries that have inherited the common law system from Britain like we did. We've decided that we are going to give every carrot and every stick to the prosecution. We're going to let them do whatever they want to marshal somebody into, taking a plea and getting that conviction at any cost. Now, you go back to 1978. In this case, I opened the book with the story of Borden Kircher versus Hayes. And that's from right down the road here in Lexington, Kentucky. You've got this guy who's a 29-year-old black horse transporter who writes a bad check for $88.30. And he gets prosecuted. Now, at that time, you know, we were not really sure as a country. There was still this popular conversation going on about how much power are we going to give prosecutors to really, you know, push people into taking deals and giving up their right to trial. Well, the Supreme Court decided that in Paul Hayes's case, because what happens there is the prosecutor comes to Paul Hayes and you wrote this bad check and you've been in some trouble with the law before. So you're going to take 5 years on this bad check, 5 years behind bar for an $88 check. And Hayes is like, I don't want 5 years for an $88 check. Prosecutor's like, all right, you don't take the 5 years, then I'm going to hit you with the habitual offender statute, and you're going to do life because it's a mandatory sentence of life if they convict you under that. So you're like, no, I'm going to take my chances with the jury. It's a profoundly brave act, I guess. You know, it looks like, if you look at the trial transcript, it looks more like bravery, you know, than just foolishness to me. And he wants to take his odds with the jury. Well, of course, they convict him. And he gets sentenced to life in prison, takes the case all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And at that point in time, there's this thought that maybe, you know, the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on this and say, no, we're not going to give all this power to prosecutors. And no, you can't threaten somebody with life in prison versus 5 years just because you don't want to go to trial. This is actually what the prosecutor said when he's examining Paul Hayes on the stand. He said, isn't it true that I told you that you were going to get a life sentence if you put me through the inconvenience, if you put the court through the inconvenience of a jury trial? And so, you know, it's not this enshrined, you know, ancient right that we, you know, it's an inconvenience, right, to this prosecutor. And Supreme Court says, well, you know, you gambled and lost. Sorry about your luck, basically, to Paul Hayes. They say that it's the prosecutor's job to persuade somebody into not going to trial. And Mr. Hayes wasn't persuaded. And so that's just how the cookie crumbles. You know, sorry about that. You do life. And what's interesting about that, and like, you know, we don't teach that case that much, but I think it's a turning point in American history. Because, you know, I talked to Vince Aprile, who practices right down the street. He represented Paul Hayes at the Supreme Court in that case. He's still in practice. And he told me that in Hayes' parole application, he got letters from, he included letters from prosecutors from all over the country who had written him saying, we would never do anything like that. We would never threaten, this is 1978, we would never threaten a defendant with life because they wanted to go to trial. Well, that's outrageous. Of course, now that's the way, you know, after two generations of lawyers since Bordenkercher versus Hayes, that's just the way we do business. Everybody knows that they can threaten you with life in prison, that they can, you know, threaten you with death. That's very common, you know, putting the death penalty on the table for somebody who won't take a plea, you know, more higher charges, or, you know, if they just want to get the case off their desk, they can charge something lower. And here's an offer you really can't refuse. Here's 6 months probation, you know, for this murder case, you know, that I don't want to go to trial on. So they've got all the tools. And this is what we've done that's so different in the United States from the rest of the world. We've given the prosecutor all the tools that they could possibly ever want to frog march somebody right into a plea bargain.
I keep getting stuck on this idea that denying the average person the ability to serve on a jury. I know people refer to jury duty as, oh, this is a terrible inconvenience to me. I don't want to do it. You know, and whereas people like me, I'm like, I'm really interested in this process. I have reasonable means. I could afford to take a week off to serve on a jury. And yet people in general view this as, you know, a profound inconvenience. And I just, that attitude to me, it's very upsetting that is the attitude that people take toward sitting in judgment of somebody that the government would like to put in jail.
It's incredible that, you know, this is the most power that you wield as a citizen. Like, the jury is where you're probably going to be your most powerful, you know, as a citizen, is sitting on a jury for most of us. And yet we have been taught, there is this popular conception that it's just a drag, it's a pain in the ass, you know, to an extent, it's driven by just financial concerns for the working class, especially, you know, down here, I think they're still paying jurors $12 a day, something like that, you know, and it's very hard to take 2 weeks off. And, you know, so judges understand that, and judges have to run for reelection. And so they're letting people off that, you know, would really be more likely approximating the peers, the true peers of your average defendant. It's practically inconceivable that you have a true jury of your peers at this point.
When you say true peers,
yeah,
to the extent that a criminal defendant is most likely of lower income, and lower income people who might be inclined to serve on that jury can't afford to take 2 weeks
Absolutely.
Off. And I think that's something that's worth clarifying.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So, I mean, there's a study out of Texas that I talk about a little bit in the book where they look at these metropolitan areas and, you know, who even shows up for jury service. And it's only about 20% of the people who are called who show up in the first place. And part of that is cultural attitudes, because it's just, you know, jury service is a drag and it's boring and it's just, you know, going to suck up your life. But I think most of it really is just, you know, the financial strain of having to take off work. And, you know, you're most of these folks that are wage and hour employees are not going to get paid, you know, for going to do jury service. They're just going to be out that money. And they simply can't take off for 2 weeks or however long. So even if they show up, you know, and they say, look, judge, I'm really in a box here. You know, I got a family to feed. I got to do this job and I'm living paycheck to paycheck. And I really don't have time or the resources to sit on this jury. Or, you know, I got a doctor's appointment. Or I got to go water the hamsters. Or, you know, whatever it is. And judges are pretty lenient about that, especially elected judges are pretty, you know, they're not gonna put you in a box and say, okay, you're going to have to do it anyway. I think for the most part, you're going to find a way to get out of it. I get people calling me all the time. How do I get out of jury duty?
In terms of reforms, to undermine this plea bargaining process that has stacked the deck in favor of prosecutors and taken average people out of the criminal justice system as a critical element of the criminal justice system. There are several things that obviously I've thought of that I've tried to have people shoot down over the years. But one is, what if jurors were simply told, hey, you may acquit for any reason that you see fit according to your conscience, and no one may second guess it.
Yeah.
That's one.
We can do that in Kentucky. I mean, we can do that. We can basically say, you know, and we've run into this in civil disobedience trials before, where, you know, we can instruct, even if it's quite clear as a matter of fact that a statute has been violated, a jury can acquit and you can instruct them on that.
But do judges do that? Is that part of jury instructions typically?
It would certainly be part of my closing argument. I don't think they'd include it in the instructions. But yeah, no, you can acquit for any reason. I mean, I think there's two ways you can get at this problem, and realistic ways, right? Because legislatures can do it, and judges to an extent have some control. But I don't think that you're going to get at the problem from the top down. Elected prosecutors can make big changes in terms of the way that they screen cases and what their priorities are for prosecution, right? And so ultimately, that's the outcome that you want to drive, is you have prosecutors that are very selective about, you know, not just cramming, you know, case after case into the system and trying to get a conviction at whatever cost. You know, and you can have a prosecutor that says, these are the charges and this is the range of penalties and that's it. Right. You know, rather than, well, let's just do this back and forth forever. And the charges aren't really the charges, but maybe the charges are something else. And if you play nice and don't go to trial, well, it's going to be this. So you can have conscientious prosecutors that are elected prosecutors. The deputies can't really do much. But you elect a prosecutor that cares about reform, that's fine. And that's one way of getting at it, but usually is only as good as the term of the prosecutor who's been elected.
Right. Short run solution.
Right. The other way is to stoke public consciousness into not being so complacent about plea bargaining. And in the book, I mean, that sounds unrealistic on its face. But in the book, I actually profile people that have done that have gone and talked to the public, like done door knocking campaigns, you know, and built broad coalitions to change public attitudes about criminal justice issues. And so I think that if you put the idea out there that, like, look, you don't have to go, like, you have a right to trial. You don't have to go and plead, even if your defense attorney says so, even if the prosecutor says so, even if the judge says so, you don't have to plead. You can take your case to trial. If you start hammering away at that as a message, you know, plea bargaining bad, right? You know, just like this basic, this is not good for America. Let's not plead every single case. Just that basic message. Can you then, you know, turn the tide of this thing like by about like 10%? Can you increase, in other words, can you increase the number of trials by 10%? If you do that, I think the system-wide effects are tremendous. And I've got a quote from Justice Berger, former Chief Justice Berger in the book, who, you know, decades ago was saying, all right, well, here we are at 90% plea bargaining rate. We're now at 97. If we go back to 80%, then that's going to just collapse the whole system. It's going to, you know, that's going to require a doubling of resources and more court staff and more prosecutor time and all this stuff. And we just can't bear 80%, you know, like plea bargaining rate. We have to have a 90% rate, which even though the whole rest of the world, like nobody tops out over 80%. Nobody. It's just us that's up here in the 90s. So if you take that, and I think that's true, if you take that for what it's worth, then a 10% swing will jam up the whole system. Well, what happens is not that the system doesn't collapse, but what happens is if you look at the examples, we've got some historical examples of Alaska and New Orleans and to a lesser extent El Paso that have experimented with doing away with plea bargainings or reducing reducing the number of bargained cases. And what happens is the system becomes more intelligent. It doesn't collapse. You know, you have a situation where prosecutors are now strapped for time in a way similar to the public defenders. And they have to make priorities. They have to make choices about the cases that they're going to prosecute and what they're going to take to the mat. And when prosecutors become more selective and start screening out more cases, then that puts pressure on police officers to get it right. If they know they're going to be on the stand, they're going to have to bring real evidence to prosecutors. They're going to have to cross their T's and dot their I's and do all the stuff that a good cop should, rather than just, all right, I'm going to make this arrest and it's going to end in a conviction, which is where we are now.
That's a very interesting element of this, that you don't really appreciate the degree to which a jury trial also disciplines police.
Absolutely. Yeah. They know right now that they can get away with whatever. So they do. You know, not only is there no accountability for the cops that are caught, but most of them just simply aren't caught because their behavior is never put under a microscope. The public's not involved. They're never going to have to take the stand. You know, if they do take the stand for something, it's going to be in a preliminary hearing where everything is just, you know, a rubber stamp for probable cause or whatever. So, you know, and it puts the prosecutor's offices like increasing the number of trials. It doesn't matter what kind of trial it is. You just increase the number of jury trials by about 10%. And this puts the prosecutor's offices and law enforcement at loggerheads, you know, until the police clean up their act and stop giving the prosecutor whatever crap they can come up with.
So you're hopeful.
Yeah, I think it can be done. I think it can be done, but I think it has to be done from the bottom up. I think top-down solutions are unlikely to work here because, you know, you get into tinkering with the legislatures and, you know, like all the legislatures right now, even the Republicans are talking a big game about how, you know, they want criminal justice reform and they want to lock up fewer people. And yet what we do every single session, especially in states like my home state of Indiana, is just ram and jam more criminal laws through. Like without really even paying attention to what the texts are. I've got a story in the book about this $1 million trespass statute. You can now be fined $1 million for trespassing in Oklahoma, $100,000 in Indiana, or facilitating trespass. I'm like, trespass is already illegal, right? No, this is for trespassing onto critical infrastructure. And every single Democrat and every single Republican in the Indiana Senate voted for this thing. And I think it passed unanimously in Oklahoma or close anyway, right? You know, and it's if you are arranging a protest that happens to trespass onto, you know, critical infrastructure, you set up a Facebook page and say, everybody come to this protest. And somebody decides that you've trespassed onto critical infrastructure during the course of that protest, then the person that set up the Facebook page can be fined $1 million in Oklahoma or $100,000 in Indiana. You know, it's just, and I talked to an Indiana legislator that, you know, voted for the law, and he's like, well, we don't know what we're voting on. This is just a thing. You know, it looks good, and you know, it's a criminal bill, and I might get stung next time around for not voting for it. So what's the harm in just voting for it? And that I think is the general attitude toward pushing new criminal laws through state legislatures.
Dan Cannon is author of the new book, Pleading Out. We spoke last week. And now it's time for a shout out to a Cato podcast sponsor, Ken Gasevich. Thank you for your ongoing support of the mission of the Cato Institute and the Cato Daily Podcast. Thank you. You can subscribe and give a rating to the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice, and follow us on Twitter @Cato Podcast.